Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we present the Fierce Reads Nonfiction Panel, a discussion of the various forms of nonfiction writing with five authors who work in the genre. In order of appearance, the writers are Achyut Dang, Keely Hutton, Alex Grondins, Ashley Woodfolk, and Jessica Vitkus. Quick note, Alex Grondins is a cartoonist and presented a slideshow of her work during her segment. If you'd like to watch this, it's available on the American Writers Museum YouTube channel. This conversation originally took place October 25th, 2022, and was recorded live via Zoom.
Welcome. Welcome to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director for the AWM. Thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program focuses on nonfiction writing and the rich possibilities, memoir, essay, graphic narratives, and more. We have five authors here tonight to talk with you about their new books and their work as writers. And we'll begin with Achyut Dang and Keely Hutton. Achyut was born in South Sudan and came to America as a refugee when she was 16 years old, a story she recounts in her new memoir, Don't Look Back. She's now an American citizen, works in human resources in a meatpacking plant in South Dakota, where she also resides. She's the mother of three sons. Keely Hutton is a children's book author and former English teacher. She worked closely with Ricky Richard Anywar to tell his story in her debut novel, Soldier Boy. Booklist named that book one of the top 10 first novels in 2017 and one of the top 10 historical novels for youth in 2018. Her second novel, Secret Soldiers, was a 2020 Bank Street Best Children's Book of the Year and 2020 Children's Book Council Notable Social Studies Book for Young People. Keely lives in Rochester, New York, with her husband, two sons, and adorable dog, Maximus. Let's welcome them into the room here.
Well, thank you, Allison, so much for inviting Achyut and me to come and speak today, especially about nonfiction. We're very excited to tell you about the memoir that we collaborated on, which is the story of Achyut Dang's life, in particular, her life as a child through her teenage years. And when we decided to work on this project together, it was an easy fit to make it a memoir because we really wanted the story to be in first person, in Achyut's voice, because we felt it would have the most impact and the most emotional connection for the readers if it was told by Achyut. So I'm actually going to let Achyut talk about, you know, the inspiration for the memoir, and then we'll go into how we collaborated together.
Hi, my name is Achyut Dang. Very happy to be here. The inspiration of this memoir started up in the spring of 2020, when I was interviewed by Caitlin Dickerson. And that started when I was interviewed by her. And my biggest fear that night when I had the COVID, it wasn't death. It was my biggest fear was that I am going to die. And my boys, my three boys, look at them right there. My biggest fear was they don't know their mom. All they know is this strong, amazing mom, but that was it. They don't know anything behind that. That was my biggest fear. And so I told her about that. And that's when I talked to, that's when Molly picked up the 20 minutes that I did with the daily podcast. And then Molly reached out to Joy, and Joy and I talked about it. So yes. So that's when the book come up.
And that's kind of when I was brought into the picture. Achyut, I know you and Joy had discussed a collaboration because Achyut had this amazing, inspirational life experience that you know, Macmillan felt should be shared. And they were looking for someone with writing experience to partner with her, you know, to bring her story to life on the page. So when Achyut and I started working together, you know, I had to dig in as a writer. I had written a book before Soldier Boy, where I worked with somebody to tell his story. And so, you know, especially when dealing with nonfiction, you know, the collecting stage of my writing process is very important. And so while Achyut was trying to recall, you know, events that happened as far back as when she was, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, I was starting to do a lot of research. And then in the meantime, we were having to talk several times a week, to give Achyut the opportunity to share her story with me so that we could start deciding, you know, what direction to take this memoir in. Achyut, did you want to explain kind of the craziness of our schedule, especially with your work schedule at the time? And we had a very tight deadline. We had like 3.5 months to get the rough, you know, the first draft done.
Yeah. So when Keely and I started it, at the time I was working night shift as a supervisor. So I would go to work at 3 p.m., don't get off until 3 a.m. So it was like a 12-hour shift. I would get off, come home at 3 a.m., sleep a little bit, 2 hours, then wake up, take my youngest son to school, come back. So our plan was Tuesday and Wednesday. Tuesday, Thursday, Keely and I will talk. And then Friday, her and I will talk again, go through the, you know, the chapter. So it was like 1 week. So Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, it was one chapter. And then she will send it to me by Thursday. And then Friday, we talk about the next chapter, you know, so, and then Saturday, I will read through the finished chapter. And then Sunday, my children and I will sit, read, talk about it. And so it was a lot. I was only sleeping 4 hours a day or less, but I was committed, and so was Keely.
And during that time, you know, while Achyut was trying to recall what had happened, I was doing research, you know, learning about South Sudan, learning about the conflict in South Sudan, learning about the refugee crisis that conflict caused, because at age 6, Achyut's village was attacked and she and her grandmother were forced to flee. So I needed to get all of the factual details down so that we could match them with the memories that Achyut had of her time in Kakuma, where she spent 10 years as a child, and then when she was finally selected to come over to the United States as part of the Lost Boys. And during this time as a writer, I'm also looking to try to find, okay, what's going to be at the heart of Achyut's story? And the very first conversation she and I had, I asked her how to pronounce her first name. And she explained to me that, you know, how to pronounce it phonetically. And then she went on to also explain that, you know, Achyut was not her name for most of her life. And Achyut, do you want to quickly explain how that went down?
Yes. So when I was born, I was named after my great grandmother, which is Achyut. But then when I was 3 years old, that name kind of like swift away, because way before I was born, years before that, someone went to the village, South Sudan, and kind of like told everybody that if you want to go to heaven or if you want to be baptized, you have to show us a name in the Bible. And so a lot of people in the village kind of like took that instead of telling people, you know, the Old Testament and the New Testament and how to go to heaven is be kind to people. It was that, okay, that is, you know, be kind, loving, but also you have to pick a name in the Bible. So long story short, that's what happened to me when I was 3 years old. I was baptized and then I was given a new name, which is Rachel. So my entire life, from age of 3, that was my name. It was a new name, except one person did not believe that, and that was my grandmother. She didn't believe that. She believed that going to heaven is being kind to people, doing, you know, being great to people. So then, that's what I told Keely. And totally, from the age of 3 until I came to America, until I got my citizenship at 27 years old, I changed that name. So the first day in class in Houston, Texas, I went to class and that changed. I knew that was not my name. So yes.
So that became the heart of the story, this sense of self. And once we had the heart of the story, then we could work through our interviews, going through all the notes and getting a timeline down, coming up with a plan. You know, I planned out the entire story, but with a chapter breakdown, so we knew what we were doing, and then started writing, started revising, you know, and I would send chapters to Achyut every week. She would review them, we'd discuss them, and then we'd move forward. And then 2 years after working together, we finally were able to meet in person a week ago Friday in Chicago, which was wonderful. It was a hug 2 years in the making. And Achyut, I'm going to let you quick wrap up with how it felt to finally share your story with your boys.
It was so hard. This box came through and my boys was like, oh my God, do you want to open it, Mom? And I told them, go ahead and open it. So we brought the box inside. It was a UPS box. We opened it and it was the book, Don't Look Back. We all opened it. We all had books except my youngest one. He had his, but he put it down. It felt really good. Finally, I had, my memoir, my past is finally here. And yes, I disobey my grandmother, but at the same time, I wanted to look back for the last time in her respect. I made it this far because of that word, don't look back. That's exactly what she told me that night of attack. Don't look back, Achyut, because it will slow you down. Keep going forward. And that's what I have done my entire life until I came up to look back for the last time. So it is in her honor.
Thank you, Achyut and Keely, for that inspiring story and for telling us about your process. You'll both be rejoining us in just a moment to participate in the Q&A. So we'll look forward to hearing from you again. Next, we are going to listen to Alex Groudon, the cartoonist behind Science Comics, The Brain, and History Comics, The Great Chicago Fire. Currently living in Rhode Island, she holds a BFA in cartooning from the School of Visual Arts and has done work for sites like the NIB and College Humor. And she has a penchant for memoirs and narratives that tackle the topics of anxiety and friendship. We are going to welcome Alex to the room.
Hello, Allison.
Hello, thanks for being here.
Of course. All right. Well, since I am a visual artist, I put together a little slideshow. Just while I'm talking, because I feel like, as you'll see, as a cartoonist, I feel like I work best when I can show my work as both words and pictures. So my book is Improve, How I Discovered Improv and Conquered Social Anxiety. And as you could probably garner, it's about me growing up with social anxiety. And then in the fall of 2016, I started taking improv classes at my local theater because I had just graduated from college. I was living with my parents in a brand new town where I hadn't grown up, so I didn't even have like relationships I could rekindle. And it was just like a very lonely period where I felt like my mental health was deteriorating a little bit more than usual. So my therapist recommended improv classes. But even before all that, I was doing a lot of diary comics on top of the work that Allison mentioned before. I'd actually been doing diary comics since probably my first year in college, so at least 10 years now, which is crazy to think about. And in the middle image here, you can even see like all the little issues I put together over the years. And one of the topics that would come up a lot was anxiety or depression or mental health. And a lot of people would gravitate towards those and saying like, oh, this is very relatable, like whenever I would sell them at conventions or post them online. So it sort of became like a staple of my work, I guess. But it was because it was what I was going through. So I would just, of course, be drawing that because it was what was relevant to me. But so as I started doing improv, I started doing little diary comics about it as well. About feeling like, oh, I'm going to be too old for everybody here, or too young. And then everyone ended up being around my age anyway. I was keeping a journal at the time, like as far as seeing my therapist went. And I had started writing about improv. And you can even see in the picture, I have a note that says partially documenting for comic reference. But for me, that meant I was going to do small diary comics about it. But what happened was it evolved into like a full-blown book because it just reached a point where I was talking about improv so much that I was like, maybe I should step back and actually write all this down instead of bugging everybody about it. So I took a lot of inspiration from books like Marbles by Ellen Forney, Something New by Lucy Nicely, and Genderqueer by Maya Kobabe, which are all books that follow like a topic, but their story spreads out across their lifetime, which I felt very much was like how it was for me, where even though improv started a very specific like period of my life, like the social anxiety went back to when I was a kid. So there were times where things would happen and I'd be like, oh, it was just like this time that this happened. So it was a lot of sort of going back and forth on things. And life doesn't make narrative sense, but you always have to construct it into a narrative when you're making a memoir or something for readers to digest. So that was another challenge in and of itself. Thankfully, because I had this journal, I basically just had to type up everything that I was writing down for myself. I was lucky enough that I actually started writing down like what would specifically happen in scenes or like funny things that somebody said to me. So I even had dates for them. But there were moments where I had to sort of fill in the blanks, like with a prologue, it was determining what happened before I started taking these classes that would sort of inform why I made certain decisions later on. Or like basically just giving people context on my life. And even though I wrote down like scenes that happened, I didn't write down like the word for word everything that happened. So what I had to do was I made like little voice memo recordings where I was kind of recreating the scenes, but at the same time, you know, it's improvised. So like I couldn't specifically follow a script. It had to sort of feel like more natural. So to do that, I basically had to sit in a room and talk to myself and play with myself, and it felt very silly, but it actually helped out a lot. So once I sort of reorganized everything into more comic format, making it more of a script, I usually print it out and sort of like draw on top of it to get like my initial ideas out of how something's going to look, or how like the page flow is going to go. So that's what you can see on the far right here. And then on top of my own experiences, like I was mostly drawing from events that already happened. I also note that I'm not an expert on the subject. I am just someone who took improv classes and also just happens to go through their own mental health struggles. But I'm not an expert and I have not studied either of them. So Improv for Storytellers was a big help for me. And you can see like I marked it up like so much because Keith Johnstone is the pioneer behind a lot of the narrative improv that the theater I went to like relied on. So I just basically went back to the basics. But then I also did research on like the connection between improv and therapy and like other people's experiences with it. Basically just trying to flesh out the information that I was trying to get out to people. Because really a lot of what this book boiled down to was not only my experience with improv and how it helped my social anxiety, but also just the interesting things that I learned from it in terms of society, like how we mirror each other or how like we constantly present each other, or even just how we learned like self-censorship. So I also, on top of that, had to do visual research, which partially included a lot of Facebook stalking. So apologize to all my friends for that. But I did a lot of studies of them from original like photos and then tried my best like simplifying them because I'd be having to draw them a lot throughout the book. And then I also would go on the internet and like hunt down photos of the place, especially because they had actually like rebuilt the entire front of their building like as I was making the book. So I had to like go find old photos. And thankfully the theater is also in the town that I live in. So I could also just go directly there to take photos, especially at the angles I was hoping to draw them at. So I was going out and getting my own reference photos. And then one of the reasons that I made this a comic as opposed to prose is, well, one, comics are what I do. But two is it's a great medium for talking about mental health, especially because in like, for example, on page 85 here in the first panel, one of the things I draw is like all these scribbles around me when like I'm feeling particularly anxious. And I feel like comics just really lend themselves to when you're struggling with words, like, which is a big thing with anxiety, you can always rely on pictures. And with this in particular, with anxiety, it's like an aura of anxiety where it's like, I'm not sure why I'm anxious, but I know I'm anxious. So that sort of gets the point across. And then you can also do abstract depictions, like in the next page with like feeling like there's a spotlight on you or anything like that. So comics really lend themselves to memoir and even just depicting stories in general. And this was just further evidence of the connection between comics are great for neurodivergence. Because sometimes when I would look at like very long textbook examples, my eyes would just glaze over and I would zone out. But comics are great because they keep you like looking all over the place. There's always something new to look at, both like on a reread and also while you're looking through the page. So it felt like there was a lot of connection between the topic of mental health and also like how I wanted to talk about myself, who is a cartoonist. And of course, I'm going to do it in comic form because that's just what I do. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. And I feel like even beyond book format, I'm going to keep doing my little diary comics because they're just the best way I can express myself. And I always recommend people try it.
Thank you so much, Alex. Now we welcome Ashley Woodfolk, who has loved reading and writing for as long as she can remember. She graduated from Rutgers University and worked in children's book publishing for over a decade. She's now a full-time mom and writer. Ashley lives in Brooklyn with her husband, dog, and baby. And her books include The Beauty That Remains, When You Were Everything, Blackout, Nothing Burns as Bright as You, and the Fly Girl series. Welcome, Ashley.
Hi. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Ashley Woodfolk, and I am going to be talking about my debut nonfiction book. It is a collection of essays based on quotations by Michelle Obama, and it's called Opening My Eyes Underwater. So the way that this book came together is actually really interesting. This was not the book that I was planning to write at all. When I, as Allison said, I worked in children's book publishing for a big chunk of my adulthood. And during one of those years, right after I started working at Macmillan, or I guess I had been working there for a while, 4 or 5 years at that point, I bumped into Jean Fywell in the elevator. So if you don't know who Jean Fywell is, she is just a publishing titan, a publishing giant. She is very much just like somebody that everyone looks up to. She is the creator of Babysitter's Club. She like low-key discovered R.L. Stein. Like, she is just everything. And so I bumped into her in the elevator and she sort of looks at me. And I was a little nervous and I was like, what? And she proceeds to say, I read your book. And I was like, okay. Because at that point, I had written a couple books, I think. I can't remember which one she had read. But I think actually just my first novel was out and I was like editing my second one at the time. So I knew she had only read my like debut and I was like, okay. And she said, have you ever thought about writing nonfiction? And I said, no. And she said, would you want to? And, you know, I'll be honest, I didn't really know. I didn't know if it was something that I could do. I didn't know if it was something that I wanted to do. I was a little bit afraid to do it, but I felt like I couldn't say no. It's Jean, and she read my book and she liked it. She also said in that moment, she was like, you're a good writer. You should write nonfiction, or you should think about writing nonfiction. And so I said yes. And I mean, behind the scenes, this is a bit of an overshare, but behind the scenes, I knew that I wanted to have a baby. I knew that I wanted to sort of write as many books as I could before I had that baby because I knew I would be taking a significant amount of time off. And I thought this sounded like a great project, like something I could try, something where I could learn something new and do something interesting that was a little bit outside of my norm. And so I said, yes. And so the book that I was contracted to write was a memoir of Michelle and Barack Obama. So she wanted to sort of redo a presidential memoir, I guess, because they were leaving office or they had recently left office. I can't remember the exact timing. But I was like, this sounds awesome. This sounds so cool. I was super nervous, of course, because I had never done anything like that before, but I was excited to get started. So I started doing all my research, reading a bunch of interviews, watching a bunch of interviews. I read a couple of Barack Obama's memoirs. And then, of course, I read Becoming by Michelle Obama. And something that just sort of naturally happened as I was doing my research is I was saving a bunch of quotations from both of them that I thought would be good to include in the book. Fast forward, I don't know, 6 months or so, I find out that I'm pregnant. I'm in the middle of sort of working on this book. I'm having a really hard time. And I don't know, it's just like not coalescing in the way that we wanted it to or in the way that we expected it to. But I keep trying. My baby is born. I take some time off. My baby gets a little older and I'm able to put him into daycare. And, you know, at this point, it's been about a year that I've been working on this book. And then the pandemic happened, during which time, of course, everything fell apart for so many people, including me, and including publishing. Like, publishing got really weird there for a little while. Like, nobody knew what was going to happen. And so we looked at what I had written so far, along with another editor named Anna, who was the one who I was working with more closely, with Jean sort of being looped in as needed. And we decided that this was not working. It just wasn't coming together, and that was okay. But we still wanted to do something together. And so I pitched them this idea of writing a collection of essays based on Michelle Obama quotations. And I had all these quotations. And so I sent them this and I sent them a sample essay. And I was like, what do you think about doing something like this? And that was kind of how this book was born. I chose the format of essays a little bit. I don't know. It just came naturally. A lot of the quotations that I had saved from Michelle Obama were quotations that I saw myself in. And so personal essays just made sense. And yeah, I mean, the essays cover everything from anxiety, dealing with anxiety, to perfectionism, racism, just like everything I felt like I experienced as a young adult that I didn't necessarily have words for. And the overarching sort of point, I guess, to the book is just to be brave, to love yourself, and to remember that you're worthy of love just because you exist, and not because you do anything or you have to do anything in order to be worthy of that love. So yeah, that is opening my eyes underwater.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Our final panelist tonight is Jessica Pitkus, a writer and television producer living in New York City. She's written craft stories and developed craft projects for Martha Stewart magazines and television, and has worked as a writer and producer for MTV News, Pop-Up Video, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and Late Night with Stephen Colbert. Welcome, Jessica.
Hello. I'm in such good company. I love hearing these stories. It's inspiring me, and as writers know, you're kind of, you live in this little bubble, and it's nice to hear about other people's process. My book came out last week, and it's a book about craft activism. It's called Crafting Change. It might be backwards. Handmade Activism, Past and Present. And it's a young adult nonfiction book about ways to fight social injustice through making things and how to speak your mind and have your voice heard through making things. So the book came out last week, and because I'm a human being with an ego, I went on Amazon to look at the listing on Amazon, and I saw at the bottom of the page, they have this algorithm that's like, if you like this book, you might like that book. And if you are interested in crafting change for young adults, maybe you want to read the following books. They offered up to the shopper. Titled one, Your Relationship to Jesus. And then titled two, Penmanship for Teens. And the third one was Farm Animals. So I think they still need to, I defy genre, and I'll take it as a compliment that they don't quite know where to put me. The book it's a mixture of profiles of artists and a little bit of historical context and also some craft projects to try, because hopefully it inspires you to go get your hands dirty and make things. So this is not a book, much like Ashley, this is not the book I was planning to write. I wasn't planning to write any book. I had a day job in television, but I went in 2017 on the Women's March in Washington, D.C. I met this editor named Joy, whose name has come up tonight. And we were marching in Washington, D.C. and having a lot of feelings and sharing them with the others around us and talking about the future and saying how difficult it must be to be a young person, especially if you can't vote. What can you do to be heard? What can you do to affect change? And then we looked around and the answer was right in front of us, or one answer. There was an ocean of pink hats. And it was really inspiring that people had, with their own two hands, made basically a uniform that united this giant, giant crowd. And if you remember those like overhead news shots, just the sea of pink, it was really inspiring that we'd made ourselves a uniform. And I have since talked more to people about, you know, the joy of making the hat and talking to people while knitting the hat. And so Joy and I decided we would write a book, or I would write a book for young people about craftivism, craft activism. And so then how do you take a big topic and wrap your arms around it? That was really hard for me to find a starting place, art and activism. It's been going on forever. So I began with a manifesto, much like a serial murderer might do. But I just sat down and wrote reasons why craft activism was important to me. I'm a longtime crafter, and it was easy for me to write about how, you know, art is a place to put your anger and a place to put your feelings and how soothing it is and how you have to kind of like heal yourself and before you can help the world, and how craft is something you can do alone, or it's something you can do with people. It's something you can do with humor. And so that was my starting place. And from there, I kind of put on my journalism hat and decided to just divide it into chapters. Each chapter would profile a kind of art, a kind of craft that's political, that helps the world. And I knew I wanted to talk about pussy hats because I had a firsthand experience and it gave me joy and inspiration. I wanted to talk about the AIDS quilt, because that's kind of the granddaddy of craft activism. And over the years that I worked on this book, if people are like, "You're doing a book about craftivism? Like, what is that?" I would just say the AIDS quilt, because that would help people understand, because that's a really clear example of how people put their feelings into a project that's beautiful. It's art, it's handmade, anybody can do it. And it's a large collective piece of art that has helped raise money and help fund research and help change the fight against AIDS. So I wrote about pussy hats. I knew I'd write about the AIDS quilt. And then from there, I needed to pick more examples. And the domestic arts, needle arts are important, but I wanted to include, sculpture and paper craft and zines and baking and photography. We all have a camera in our pocket, and a camera is a very powerful tool of art. You can document injustice, you can make something beautiful, and we all have one. So I wanted people to think about that, young people especially, with their phones. So I started looking for each chapter for a person to interview, an artist who's active and working with the community to help people make things. And for the history parts, like the AIDS quilt, and I did some things from the way back past, I spoke with historians. So each chapter was some historical context and then a one-on-one interview with a person to, because art and history is just more fun for me to just talk to a person and have them help me through learning about this new area and get excited about their work. So I took about a year to write a draft, and I turned it in. But, you know, funny thing is sometimes you have to do things wrong before you do them right. And my draft had a lot of problems. And the biggest problem was I wrote it chronologically. I started with there were these craft markets in the 1830s that where women made shawls and quilts and raised money to fight slavery. And it was an amazing topic I learned so much about, didn't know about, spoke to a historian. And then I wrote about women who knit for the war effort in World War I and World War II. People knit bandages and mittens for soldiers, and then the AIDS quilt. And I went on through time. But when I looked at the whole picture, it looked like a bad encyclopedia. It felt like just giant gaps in time. And I felt like I was trying to cover this huge topic and kind of failing. So Joy, my editor, helped me a ton. She said, just for her words, but just pull it apart and put it back together. And that's exactly what I did. I rearranged all the chapters, kind of stood by themselves. You didn't need one to lead to the next. So I rearranged the whole entire book by art form. So the quilts are with the quilts and those women who were raising money to fight slavery back in the 1830s. Their quilt chapter was next to the AIDS quilt chapter. And I love that juxtaposition. It was really great. And there's a modern group, there's a current organization called Social Justice Sewing Academy that's making quilts today, workshops with young people. And the AIDS quilt is still alive and people are still making panels for it. So I love that those three topics were clustered together in a section. And then I had a section on sculpting, and there's a person that builds houses, zero waste houses out of tires and sand and bottles, and that's with the sculptor. That chapter is next door to a chapter about a woman who leads workshops and people sculpt with clay objects that people have held in their hands when police have shot them. Like people, victims of gun violence from police have often been holding something, an iPhone, a bag of candy, and the police will use it as an excuse to shoot. And this woman has workshops where people come together and they make those objects out of clay, where you really meditate on the objects and think about, you know, the how this object is nothing like a gun. The project is called This Is Not a Gun. And that's next, that chapter is next to the chapter about building zero waste houses, and they're both kinds of sculpture. And it ended up being a much more freeing way to organize the book. And I realized the book is more like a cookbook. It's you can flip around and just pick the parts you want, or a travel guide. Like you don't have to read every page front to back. You just read the parts that are interesting. So that reorg helped me a lot and was liberating. And around this time, COVID happened and it changed the nature of everything. It changed the nature of protest. It changed the way people get together and make things. It made it, sewing circles and knitting circles couldn't happen for a while. And Black Lives Matter protests were sweeping across the nation. And I really also I realized my book was not inclusive enough. And I really needed to stop. So then I reworked the book again, adding more artists of color, adding what I was learning from what was happening in the nation. I'm so glad. If it had been published before the pandemic, the book just wouldn't have been, it just wasn't ready. It didn't reflect what was happening in our country. So I updated the book that way, added more artists, and I just kept adding artists, and I added people who bake cakes, and I added graffiti, and I just really wanted to expand the idea of things you can make without any training your first day, just to get your voice out there. And then the last part of the book was craft projects. I'm a longtime crafter and I worked with Martha Stewart, and I craft to soothe my own soul. So I added, it's like putting recipes at the end of the book. So that was the journey I went on. And hopefully by the time you read a couple of chapters, you want to get your hands dirty. You want to try it yourself. And so this book is my call to action. It is very personal, the way these other authors are talking about their personal books. And so I hope I get a new generation going and speaking out and making things.
Thank you, Jessica, so much for sharing that with us. Well, we could listen to you talk all night, and I wish that we could, but unfortunately we are out of time this evening. So I want to thank all of you for being here and sharing your stories and your fierce reads with us. And thank you very much to all of the attendees who joined in tonight.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Stuart N. Brotman and John Palfrey discuss Brotman's new book, The First Amendment Lives On, a collection of conversations with free speech scholars and advocates. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.